Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And as you know, I have a really broad definition of love letters, which is simply enough, your truth put to paper in a compassionate and loving way, stamped and mailed to somebody. There's no point in taking gratitude to the grave. It doesn't serve anyone. You might as well write it down and stamp it and mail it and make somebody else's life better. Today's guest is a miracle in so many ways, Robert Kaplan, who happens to be a cousin through marriage and a man I've known for a long time, and only yesterday discovered more about him and his really miraculous story. And I'm going to go right to you. Would you please just start in with your life and what growing up was like and talk about you?
Well, soon after I was born, my parents separated and divorced. And because of that year, which was 1937, I, through circumstances, was placed in an orphanage. And
Because your mother had to work in those days?
My mother had to work, and it was a very, very difficult condition to be a divorcee in those years. It was an embarrassment to both families. And my mother didn't. Initially, I was moved around to different relatives, but it became a burden because as an infant, you know, there's a lot of care. And and so her solution was to put me in a foundling home, basically, a very beautiful place, which I was way too young to know. And my mother's brother, my Uncle Ted, paid for that. And from there, I moved to other institutions. I was in a Baptist children's home. I was born to Jewish parents, but they were more than reformed. So I didn't get a Jewish heritage around education and rituals and family gatherings. I was more exposed to Christianity. The first home was, after the foundling home, was a Baptist children's home right here in Detroit. And I was there for quite a while and got very sick. I was so sick that I had to be moved to a foster home. And when I was about 2.5, 3 years old, I was in a foster home with a very, very special foster mother.
She was good to you?
She was very good.
Oh, and that's so nice.
Her name was Effie Hogan, and I lived in her home in Clawson, Michigan, for about 3.5 years. And that was the first time in my life that I had security, inclusion, I belonged,
and so
I was nurtured. Although she was strict, there was usually about 5 or 6 other foster kids in the home. She was very caring and loving.
What made it that that period came to an end?
Eventually, my mother, with the help of my uncle, bought a small home in Detroit, and I moved at the age of 6 to live with my mother.
Oh, and that's where you were from then on?
No.
Oh, okay.
Because of my development and emotional state, I did very poorly in elementary school. And at some point when I was 10 years old, my mother found out about this other school, which was really a private school, a Catholic school. I attended Catholic boarding school from the age of 10 till 12. That was really where I learned to read and become a little bit more able to function in school. So I lived with my mother from 12 forward.
Mm-hmm.
Until I was 18, and I joined the... I had gone to college, Highland Park Junior College, and I went there for 2 years, and then I was... drafted into, well, I joined the Navy Reserve to stay out of the draft because what was happening after Korea was they were drafting a lot of college students and to make up the loss of military personnel that were being mustered out after Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So after 2 years of college, I was activated, and I had to go on active duty.
Is that how you found yourself on the carrier?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right. I was...
So what happened to you, this accident? Can you just...
Well, my job aboard the aircraft carrier was a plane captain, and mm-hmm. a plane captain is that person who assists the pilot with his gear and helps the overall readiness of the plane, making sure it's safe and flyable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been on that job for about 6 months when on the final phase of the my job was to help the pilot pre-flight the aircraft. And during the pre-flight... I was actually sucked into the intake of my assigned plane.
Is that a jet?
Yeah, it was a jet. I went headfirst into the intake, and at that time, it was a major event. It happened during a launch, a pre-dawn launch, and they had to pull the plane off to the side. It disrupted the entire activity that is so well orchestrated.
Oh, not to mention disrupting you.
Yes, disrupting me.
How did you, who got you out of this physically?
One of the men, mm-hmm. well, I was told.
Yeah.
One of the men.
You must have been unconscious.
I was unconscious. In fact, I had, one of the men had to crawl into the intake.
Oh.
And to discover that it was too hot in there, and my clothes, my sleeves and everything were caught up in the turbine, and he had to leave the intake and wait approximately 20 minutes for the plane to cool off, and he climbed back in with scissors and mm-hmm. cut my jacket off.
So you were unconscious, half swallowed by this jet.
Yeah. I was pulled out of the intake, laid out on the flight deck, on and given last rites. The Jewish chaplain was not available at that time, and so they called the Catholic chaplain, mm-hmm. Father Fitzpatrick, to administer to me, and I had no life signs, and he was kneeling over me. And I was watching him from above.
Oh.
I had left my body, and I was watching this ritual of this Catholic priest who was very, very, what's the word, in resistance to giving last rites to a Jewish young man.
Uh-huh.
He felt he was not the right person to do this.
Uh-huh.
And
that sounds respectful of him.
Was very respectful, but he was very agitated.
Sure.
And I watched him pull out a lavender ribbon and put it around his neck. I was very aware of his emotional state.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back into my body, opened my eyes, much to his surprise, because I had no life mm-hmm. signs. And I spoke to him.
Wait, can I ask you something? You were talking about being aware of his emotional state from being out of your body.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of your emotional state out of your body?
I had no emotional state.
Okay.
I would say that my awareness mm-hmm. was pure that. It okay. had no sensual uh-huh. quality to it. It was...
Not earthly.
It was a much broader yes. perspective of awareness.
Okay. So when you opened your eyes, he was surprised.
He was very surprised. And what I said to him was, Father, you're not a rabbi. Don't you know I'm Jewish? I have never had any relationship in my whole life with a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
But some aspect of me knew that I was uh-huh. Jewish. And he looked so startled. I'll never forget the way in which this transpired.
What did he say?
He was dumbfounded. He didn't say anything. And I could feel that conflict in him. And so I said, it's okay, Father. You'll do.
Oh.
And then I left my body.
Again.
I was in and out of my body three or four times during this process. So they took me down to sick bay, and the ship was, at that time, the largest ship in the world. And we had six doctors aboard mm-hmm. that ship. And they were all involved in my body.
Could I ask you something about your body? Your physical injuries must have been huge.
They were huge.
I mean, brain and yeah. torso and
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
My right arm was almost completely off.
Okay.
I had a very severe concussion. And my back was broken.
My
arms, both arms were compound fractured. They mm-hmm. were severely broken. And my leg was broken, my ankle, I should say. And, I had the largest number of fractures to that date that has ever been recorded uh-huh. by a single injury at the Portsmouth Naval Hospital. Eventually, after they revived me, and by the way, I had no life signs when they took me down to the sick bay and began to ascertain what the extent of my injuries were. But Father Fitzpatrick told them that I had spoken to him.
Okay.
So because of that, they continued to try to revive me.
They didn't give up on you.
They did not give up on me.
Did you want them to? Sometimes you hear about people who really want to be let go. They don't want to be forced back into this earth. Did you have any feelings about that?
I did not.
Okay.
I did not have that awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I did not have that awareness. I was unconscious for 48 hours. And during that time, I was in and out of my body a number of times, and I was observing.
How long did it take you? I mean, to look at you, this is one of those I wish it were a television moment, because to look at you,
mm-hmm.
you would never guess that there was a sign of anything devastatingly injurious.
Yeah, I know. It is a surprise. Most of my injuries are not that noticeable.
Not from out here, they're not.
Yeah. I mean, I have a scar that runs from my forehead all the way up here.
I have
a lot of scars.
I see. Okay.
And they had...
But the way you function is... Yes.
The way I function is a result mm-hmm. of being here in this life mm-hmm. and having the pathway from birth until the present
mm-hmm.
That has shifted things for me. The near-death experience is what I had alters people.
Okay, so that's clearly what I'm getting to and really what I want you to talk about because mm-hmm. you do a lot of work on that area now.
Yeah.
But go ahead, talk about near-death and what that teaches you or what... Go ahead.
Well, the most significant thing for me around the near-death experience, my near-death experience, is that it leaves you with an awareness
mm-hmm.
that this physical life, is really one dimension
mm-hmm.
that has great purpose and meaning for the individual, but it's not the only reality.
Well, what is the purpose and meaning? Is it a preparation somehow, or it's just purpose and meaning on its in its own right? Family and love and...
It's difficult to answer that precisely because, mm-hmm. for one thing, I feel that the principle of purpose is unique to each individual. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, you can talk about a generalization, but it really doesn't transfer so easily to the individual. It's almost unspeakable. My sense is that this physical life is really about balance. So our purpose has to do with somehow balancing experience.
You help people. I know you do counseling and you work with groups and you speak. Is that what you do with people to help them find a balance? What's your goal with people when you...
My main purpose, mm-hmm. is to acknowledge their physical existence, mm-hmm. as one aspect of their overall existence. That there's many
planes of existence.
There's many aspects, uh-huh. to what we would call their identity. They're not just in this one physical body.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's a difficult thing to speak about because it's non-linear. Mm-hmm. There are many things about the body which are simultaneous, mm-hmm. and spontaneous. So to transfer it into language conceptually, you're almost, it'd be like looking at a photograph and as being separate from experiencing the scene that you're in, the scene that is being portrayed in the photograph.
Now, but people come to you for counseling. You refer to what you do now, your business, so to speak, is called Life After Breath. Isn't that wonderful? Yes.
Life After Breath.
Yes.
I know from experience that we exist beyond this domain.
Do you think many people know this?
I think that there's a seed in every being that has the potential to reveal this. And some people are, we might say, are further along.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a difficult thing to say, further along.
Well, you know, I sometimes look at people and I have a real sense of spiritual sophistication. And I think it's a talent, just like perfect pitch or being able to draw. People have different abilities to recognize things.
Yes.
I mean, you see that among people. And I'm wondering, you know, Oliver Sacks wrote a book on hallucinations. I don't know if you've read it.
Mm.
And the whole business of hallucinating among sane people,
mm-hmm.
and people seeing things and people, oh, it's so interesting. And I wonder if that's part of the same package you're talking about. People hallucinate people from their past or people they've never met, or they have, as you say, simultaneous things going on that seems to manifest itself in what we call hallucinations. But the possibilities are so huge.
Yeah, hallucination in the era that I grew up, and even now, probably has a negative connotation to it. That you're making something up that really isn't there.
That's right. That's right. Instead of seeing something that really is.
The base...
In some way.
A word that I've chosen to be more... humane, mm-hmm. and familiar with people is imagination. We have the gift to imagine virtually anything. Our nature is infinite. We live in a domain where you're born, and we refer to that as the beginning of life.
Yes, we do.
And then you have these journeys, and then you die, which is supposed to be the end. But when it comes to imagination, you can relate to the idea. You can create something in your imagination, and when you leave that focus, when you decide to shift your awareness, you don't die, but the image dies. The image leaves, and you're now focused elsewhere.
That's what death is. You're simply focused elsewhere. And we do it all the time.
It's so you're saying death is the end of a particular kind of focus.
I refer to this life as an idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's an animated, lucid, like a lucid dream, idea that has a consensual quality to it. And it is
consensual between people, that we have to kind of acknowledge that.
Yeah, we're locked into time.
Yes.
We're locked into space. And we're locked into a way of being.
We're locked into time without really understanding what it is.
Right.
I mean, if our watches are coordinated, we'll be at the same restaurant at the same time so we can see each other.
Right.
But I don't know where we ever got deluded into thinking that was time. It's convenient.
It would be called a convention.
Yes. Okay, good. Thank you.
And it's useful. It's useful here.
Yes, definitely.
But it can also get in the way. You can be afraid of time. Some people are, well, you know, I work as a chaplain in a local community hospital in Boulder, and there are people being born in that hospital, and two floors up, there's people dying in that hospital.
Yes.
So it's like a hotel. You have arrivals and you have departures.
You know, my granddaughter recently said to me, "Why do people have to die?" She's five. She said, "Why do people have to die?" I said, "Sweetheart, you know, that's such a big question. It's a very important question. People have been asking that forever." And she suddenly brightens up. She said, "Oh, I know why they have to die." And I said, "Why?" She said, "To make room for the new people." And I thought, well, good for her. But I like that image of a hotel. It's like passing through. You know, being born into it, and then upstairs people are checking out.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people are frightened to check out.
But a lot of people aren't.
So that's correct.
So where do you draw that distinction? Why some frightened and some not, do you think?
Because each of us is elegantly unique.
Okay.
And we're not all thinking the same thoughts with the same rationale. And we are on a very, very singular, private, individual journey that we share with others. But all of us are unique, like no other being that has ever been in a body.
Yes.
And that's something that I don't feel our culture, this Western culture, acknowledges very much. We all have different Social Security numbers and driver's license numbers, but for the most part,
go ahead.
For the most part, our culture does not acknowledge the supreme uniqueness.
Mm-hmm. So, do you help as a chaplain? Do you help people make this transition more easily, or is that your goal, or what?
It's interesting that the phone rings.
because
life is spontaneous.
Yes, yes.
Yes, I have had the sacred privilege of assisting people to pass over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I can literally know that they are having an easier time because of my presence, but I hold the ground of the sacred experience of being in human life and passing over to the other side. We call it the other side. And I know that it is an expression of the grandest love.
Do you think... I'm just gonna be bursting into tears in a minute. Do you think the fact that you know that there is a passing over into another side is helpful to people who are dying? Does it give people confidence?
Overall, I would say yes.
I would think so.
It releases them from the grip of the unknown.
Do you personally see a lot of evidence that there is another side? Oh, well, of course you do. You were on the other side.
Oh, yes. There's.
Yeah.
I mean, we are multidimensional human beings.
Yeah.
We're not limited to our gender. We're not limited to
Clearly.
Our age.
Yes.
And we tend to be here to discover. We're here to discover and uncover and realize. It's an extraordinary aspect of our nature, and our nature is creative.
So it is kind of preparatory, the way you're talking about it, just like fetal life is preparatory for after that. Or am I off track?
Well, when you mention fetal, my own way of holding this metaphorically mm-hmm. is it's like having a custom car made. You've ordered this car, and they're making it according to your specifications. And you're not in that car yet.
Oh, okay.
So once the car is made, you join it.
Ah.
That's when it works.
Okay. So you're seeing the soul as...
Yeah, we take uh-huh. possession of the body. Now,
I thought of that.
It's just a metaphor.
Yes.
It probably is not really how
no,
it is.
I understand, but I never heard that metaphor. Yeah.
It makes sense to most people because they're familiar with being a car.
Yes,
a car has a separate driver.
Yes.
And when the car wears out, the driver gets out and gets another car.
Oh, I like that. Okay. Now, I have a question to ask you since I'm about love letters, and I think every life experience has the seeds in it of a love letter to someone, hopefully many. And there's something about writing it down in your own handwriting, documenting your own history in your own hand, I think is so valuable for people to find later, for the people who get the letter. If you were to write a love letter right now, I hope you go home and do one, who would it be to? I can think of about 14 people already from what you've said. And I know you have a beautiful family of children and grandchildren.
The most authentic answer, the most direct answer mm-hmm. That I would write this letter to would be myself.
Oh, good. I like those.
I feel so strongly that the way my life has unfolded, that I have searched and wanted to be loved by somebody out there, mm-hmm. My mother, my father, who I barely knew, but it can be friends. It's a very simple formula that we are the embodiment of love itself. Now, to me, love is not the transaction that typically is experienced by people. I love you, mm-hmm. or you love me, or you love your dog. Love to me is creation itself.
So how would you start this letter to yourself?
How would I start
it? Let's just give an example.
I would address the lost little child that I was, mm-hmm. and I can still feel that child. That child is not dead. That mm-hmm. child is accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But I would address it to the lonely, unattached mm-hmm. Child that was always looking for love outside
of
myself.
So how would you phrase this? How would you acknowledge this? And would it be to encourage or to congratulate or to, in some sense, say, good for you, you've found it, you've done it?
When I was out of my body, mm-hmm. watching them try to revive me aboard the ship, I was on a gurney, and there were probably 8 or 10 men mm-hmm. Around the gurney. There wasn't any space. It was all men around mm-hmm. me. They were all trying. And what I realized looking at my body, and I knew everything about my life at that mm-hmm. time, and I knew it without thinking. That's an important thing mm-hmm. For me anyway, that I had a direct knowing.
It didn't take processing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the words that came to me, which were not vocal words, they, mm-hmm. They were not audible, mm-hmm. but the words that came to me when I was looking at my, is that I am the love I seek.
Okay. Oh.
I am the love I seek. Now that was my story.
Yes.
It isn't necessarily everybody else's story.
So let me ask you, If you were to do, I hope you do. I hope you go home and write it on stationery that won't corrode easily, indelible ink, and you mail it to yourself. Stamp it and mail it to yourself, and you will be surprised at the little heart thud you get when you see that you've received a letter, a love letter, from yourself, and then you take it and you go read it somewhere, because reading a love letter is private. And I know that you will be amazed, because the person who writes that letter to self is a different person than the one who reads it.
Yes. Yes.
Will you let me know how this strikes you after you've done it?
I will, Janet.
Okay.
I will.
Thank you for telling us so much.
I don't know if you
will. And let's have your website, please, really quickly. You have a website that you might like people to know about. Yes?
Yes.
What is it?
It's Robert Kaplan.
Robert.
Kaplan. HFC. That stands for High Frequency Communications.
Okay.
Robert Kaplan, HFC.com.
This is just so worth taking a visit into this man's life for the insight and the humor and the... It's just exceptional. Anyway, I know that we're running out of time. Did you want to read that? You read that.
Did you read it?
Yes, I did, but you read it in your voice.
Okay, this is how I would like to inspire people to affirm their own existence, myself and as well as all the other beings that might be listening. I am here to love to the best of my heart's desire, to be as accepting of all parts of my life that I can possibly allow, and to remind myself there is a presence within all that exists, and it's living my life.
Thank you. The fact that you are alive and here and doing what you do is really a miracle and an indication that you are meant to be here to do something, I would think. And I want to thank you for just sharing all this and talking about things that people don't usually get to talk about. And until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye for now.